Today is National Chocolate Covered Insect Day. This is not a day that a lot of people celebrate, but our guest today on Focus is certainly taking notice. May Barenbaum chairs the Department of Entomology, the study of insects, at the University of Illinois, and she says insects have served as a food of choice in many parts of the world. She can tell you about them, as well as other things about insects, such as, oh, those giant hornets in Asia that have made the news recently for attacking people. And then there are so-called zombie insects whose brains are controlled by other insects. I'm Jim Meadows, May Barenbaum on Insects Today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. This is WILL AM 580 and will.illinois.edu, listener-supported public radio. This is our fall pledge drive. To make your pledge of support, call 217-244-9455 or donate online at willpledge.org. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. May Barenbaum is a frequent guest on Focus, and we are pleased to welcome her back to the program today. She's the longtime chair of the University of Illinois Department of Entomology, our study of insects, and a noted researcher in the field herself. May Barenbaum's research looks at the chemical interactions between insects and the plants they live on, and the greater environmental implications of those interactions. May's also known for her creative methods in educating the public about insects. For instance, the U of I's Insect Fear Film Festival has been correcting the bad science in insect horror movies for 30 years now. And May Barenbaum's books include Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs, 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers. I have a copy with me. And germane to one of our discussions today, May is a contributor to Man Eating Bugs, The Art and Science of Eating Insects. May Barenbaum, welcome back to Focus.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I should note, your questions about insects are very welcome. If you have questions about exterminating insects, this is probably not the day we can help you. But if you've been curious about anything concerning insects, May Barenbaum may be able to help you. So call in with your questions at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Again, welcome to Focus May, and happy National Chocolate-Covered Insect Day.
Well, thank you so much. I went to the Hallmark store, and you wouldn't believe it. There are no cards for happy National Chocolate-Covered Insect Day.
I don't know why. It's all over the internet, although nobody seems to have any information about who decreed it National Chocolate-Covered Insect Day. I even found a website that says it specializes in holidays, saying specifically, we don't know where this came from. There are no official government proclamations for National Chocolate-Covered Insect Day, but they all agree it is today, Monday, which is also Columbus Day.
I know nothing in the history of entomophagy, the
entomophagy,
eating insects, the practice of eating insects, that would associate this particular date. I don't know if it's October 14th every year or the whatever second Monday in October as National Chocolate-Covered Insects Day. I can say that when Columbus traveled to the New World, he did almost certainly encounter entomophagy among the native people. But that doesn't really explain the chocolate cover, does mm-hmm. it?
It's not just a punchline. I gather insects are, as food, are serious business for some people.
All around the world, except for contemporary Western culture. And as a consequence, we're kind of spilling over into the rest of the world, where many countries have had longstanding traditions of eating insects are starting to look askance because in the developed world it's not done generally, but it's getting more popular. There's a lot more interest in it.
Well, I was wondering, all I know about eating insects is from a book I read from the 1980s by Marvin Harris called Good to Eat, Riddles of Food and Culture. You know this book?
I do know that book.
There's a chapter called Small Things. And what I remember from that chapter is it was very practical. It was talking about ancient civilizations and people who would have been really living on the edge of starvation. So what they eat was an important calculation of how nutritious is it and how difficult is it to obtain. You had to factor the two things together. So what Marvin Harris wrote, that what you needed for insects were things that were big and fleshy to give you nutrients, and also slow-moving and or available in great quantities. So I guess what, larvae, grubs, locusts, those are the sort of things that people eat?
Pick your continent. There are all kinds of things. That's the nice thing about insects. There's a million different menu items potentially. So big and fleshy isn't necessarily a requirement. It's kind of a plus. But pick a continent. There are many, many different kinds of insects that are super abundant, particularly at certain times of year. And often those are associated with entomophagy. And in general, it's been practiced in societies where there are no large game animals. So, again, it's widely accepted, but there is, even in the developing world, a prejudice in favor of big game. So even among arthropods, I guess big game are looked on more favorably.
Well, where do you go in the world to really find this practice where the best game available happens to be a bug?
I guess that depends on your preferences. But again, pre-Columbian Mexico and even contemporary Mexico, just across the border, frequent menu items include today chapulines, which are grasshoppers, chili pepper grasshoppers. There are humiles, which are prepared in tacos. Those are stink bugs, which are very pungent, spicy, if it were. Actually, a lot of true bugs, relatives of stink bugs, are eaten all over the world because of their unique and distinctive aroma and taste. Ant eggs, escamoles, are also on the menu in around the world, including in contemporary Mexico.
Now, I should note, none of the Mexican restaurants I have been to in the Champaign-Urbana area seem to have these on the menu.
But there are in Chicago. There are at least two.
There are
two
restaurants in Chicago
that serve chapulines.
These are Mexican restaurants.
Yeah,
very special Mexican restaurants.
And I think they're even on the menu, even in translation. There's also a Thai restaurant in Chicago where you can get insects.
What do the Thai eat?
Among the more popular items that are not necessarily served at Sticky Rice, which is the restaurant in Chicago, giant water bugs, mung da, they're called. Again, the same family as the stink bugs. They are very pungent, and they're used in making chilies. Various and sundry eggs of ants and other insects, other Thai bamboo worms, which are actually caterpillars, and those are on the menu in the restaurant called Sticky Rice. I have right here a paper that just came out in the Journal of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering, 2013, Escamoles Ant Eggs, Source of Metal Ions for Human Health. So this is a scientific study coming out of Mexico documenting the nutritional value of eating ant eggs. So very much a subject of global interest right now.
But of course, now ant eggs, it sounds like you either have to cultivate an ant farm or ant colony, or else you're going to be an ant hill marauder, I guess, to get these things.
Well, it's always better if you're growing your own, I think. Mm-hmm. It's not like too many people are out hunting cows right now either, or shooting wild jungle fowl. So that's the push, actually, has been globally to promote the domestication or semi-domestication of or mass rearing of insects for the purpose of consumption. And again, that they're the whole prize, $1 million prize in Canada, was awarded to a team for developing flour. They call it power flour, which is a flour that's made with dried insect protein. So this is worth $1 million. The EU awarded $1.5 million it was the EU, so it was
European
euros.
Union?
One and a half million euros.
Euros, of course.
To promote the development of mass-reared insects for human consumption.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We are talking about insects, right now the edible kind, with University of Illinois Entomology Chair May Barenbaum. You can call us with your insect questions toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Email your questions to will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. The phone number again is 1-800-222-WILL. You can send questions to Twitter or Facebook to us at Focus580. Is insects as food, is this part of the curriculum? Is this part of your coursework?
I do teach a course called Insects and People. It's a general education course for non-scientists. And what I try to do is relate to
these are for the English majors.
Exactly. Yeah, who don't think they're interested in insects. But the point of the course is to explain to them how intricately associated, how closely interwoven our lives are with the lives of insects. And that includes, among other things, around the world, eating insects. Now, we all eat insects whether we like it or not. The Food and Drug Administration publishes sort of minimum or maximum acceptable levels of insect contamination, so parts and excrement. So you can look up.
You're not really getting the best part along those lines.
No, those are sort of bits and pieces, and I don't think excrement's anybody's favorite menu item. But like it or not, we're eating insects on a regular basis. Even the strictest vegan, if you're eating vegetables, there are probably insect parts on at least some of them.
Okay, I'm wondering. Well, let's say, for instance, you just look over here at the continental United States, and people may not be eating insects much. But if you were looking for an insect which would be useful to cultivate, which would be worth your while in terms of nutrition versus effort, where would you start to look?
Well, I can tell you some ongoing efforts right now at University of Idaho, for example. There's a big problem. There's a big fishing industry in Idaho, and a big problem is fish offal, O-F-F-A-L, waste, fish guts, fish skin, fish. And it's a big problem. It's a source of pollution. It's a potential bacterial contamination. Well, the investigators at Idaho discovered that there are carrion flies. They're called soldier flies, Hermetia illucens. Which love fish guts, and you can rear these maggots in huge tubs and then feed the maggots to farmed fish. Now a lot of farmed fish are being fed soybeans. So, it's kind of bizarre to think that we're growing soybeans to feed to fish to eat the fish. That's not very efficient, but nobody is eating the fish guts. You can feed the maggots on the fish guts, feed them, and then give the maggots to fish, and then the fish actually end up with a better array of polyunsaturated fatty acids, which are nutrients for us, than they do if they eat plant protein or plant food material.
That
so that's going
we were,
on.
We were talking about it for people, but as food for livestock.
Oh, absolutely. But
not livestock here, is it?
Well, people farm fish.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. That's like, well, it's certainly commercially farmed food. And so that's a way that insects can be used commercially to feed people because we will eventually eat the fish.
There are companies. There was a company, for example, started by a guy whose entire career has been focused on promoting edible insects, David Gracer. He called it initially the land shrimp, which I thought was very clever because shrimp are arthropods, jointed-legged animals with an external skeleton, and they're very closely related to insects. And nobody looks askance at you if you eat shrimp or lobster or crab. But frankly, they're not that different from insects.
What about flavor?
Well, actually, here's the disclaimer here. I'm a vegetarian. I don't even eat lobster, shrimp, or crab, so much less insects. But
what do people tell you?
People actually who try insects, depending on the species, actually enjoy them. If you fry it, it tastes fried. It's basically everything fried tastes more or less the same. Those giant Thai water bugs, we actually had them one year for our Insects and People class. I give a lecture on edible insects, and we have a lab, and we prepare dishes as they are prepared in their native country. And we made tempura water bugs, tempura mangda, and I wish we had more. I mean, people loved them. They thought they tasted like a combination of chicken, coconut, and pineapple.
Chicken always seems to come in here when you're talking about talking about unusual foods. I want to take a call from line one, our caller in Belgium, Illinois. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning, all. Good morning, Miss Birnbaum.
Hi.
You just touched on the thing that I was going to ask. You said we don't eat bugs, but we do eat crayfish, lobster, crabs, and all. They're awfully, awfully close to bugs.
That's absolutely true. And it's what people don't realize when Europeans first settled in New England, they really regarded lobster as complete and utter garbage food for the poorest of the poor. It was very déclassé to eat lobster. And, you know, look at a lobster. It looks like a bug. In fact, there's a relative of a lobster that it's eaten in Australia, in Queensland area. It's called the Moreton Bay bug. And it's actually a crustacean like shrimp and lobster. And for some reason, we've gotten over our aversion to looking at legs and antennae and eyes staring back at you when it comes to crustaceans.
Now, obviously, you're very big on bugs. How much difference is there between a crustacean and what you consider an insect?
Oh, well, I guess I'm not the one calling the boundaries. The insects, technically speaking, are the ones with three body regions, six legs, and one pair of antennae. And as it turns out, people tend to think spiders and insects are pretty closely related. One has six legs, one has eight legs. And whereas crustaceans, lobsters, or crabs are decapods, they have 10 legs. In reality, if you know, molecular biology and direct examination of DNA and complete genomes has indicated that crustaceans are closer to insects than spiders are.
So essentially they are bugs, but we have to divide them into another section.
Right. You can use the term bug because it doesn't – well, it has two meanings, a scientific meaning, but it also has a general meaning of sort of leggy creatures that have a hard external skeleton. And in that sense, they are bugs.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Good day.
Thank you. And let me take a second call. This is line two. Carl from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning, and thanks for the very interesting program. Perhaps you've covered this, but what are these small pinpoint – black biting bugs that have a bite well beyond their characteristic size.
That are out right now?
You bet.
They are probably minute pirate bugs. These are tiny, tiny. Pirate is kind of a not exactly descriptive. They're little tiny bugs. If you look at them, it looks like they have sort of attractive wing markings. They are predators. And what kind of predator is a bug the size of a pinpoint going to attack things even smaller? They'll feed on immature forms of very small insects. They'll eat eggs. And this time of year, they're a little desperate and a little confused because the corn is being harvested, the soybeans drying out, and all of their meal tickets are gone. So they're kind of casting about, looking for something to eat. And when they bite you, in their because they're tiny, they inject sort of a paralytic kind of saliva to immobilize their prey, and that's what gets into you, and it hurts like crazy. They don't want to eat you. They're not taking anything out. They are probably as horrified as you are that, I don't think we taste good to them. We don't taste like insect eggs. But it'll pass. They're actually beneficial species because they help control pest insect populations. But you're right. How such a tiny little bug can pack such a punch is really amazing.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. And, you know, we had an email from Kate, who identifies herself as a graduate student here at the U of I and wishes us a happy National Chocolate-Covered Insect Day. And she had a question for you, May, about, I think, the same thing. She was making a guess that they were insidious flower bugs.
Same name. I mean,
pirate,
same species.
The pirate bug and the flower insidious. Yep. Why insidious?
Oh, well, because they're so tiny.
That's what it means.
Their scientific name is Aureus insidiosus. So they are insidious. They're exactly, they have, that's the problem with common names. It's different groups of people call the same insect by different names or even different stages of the same insect. For example, the black swallowtail butterfly is the parsley worm or celery worm in its larval stages. But yes, the insidious flower bug is, in fact, a minute pirate bug in the family Anthocoridae.
Well, Kate was wondering if this leads to a larger question that she has about insects, bugs, and flies. Why do some people have more trouble with them than others? She writes, whenever there are mosquitoes, or for example, these little black bugs, I seem to be swatting like crazy while others are not bothered. Is there a neat biological reason for this, or am I just unlucky?
No, well, I think the answer to both alternatives is yes. This is the multi-million-dollar question, and I'm more attractive to fleas than the cats are in our house. So there have been intensive efforts to isolate the attractants and the differences among people, and there's progress along that front. In general, external parasites, ectoparasites, are attracted, generally speaking, to pulsed CO2. In other words, exhaling. Some are responsive to lactic acid, which is produced in sweat. Some are sensitive to temperature. There's some suggestion that there are other volatile skin emanations that are attractive. So, and those vary from person to person. So that people are working on the individual differences, but they are real and they are pretty frustrating. I just want to say, I think it's funny we started out talking about men eating bugs, and now we're talking about man eating bugs. So
yes,
so we're all a question of punctuation. So,
and of course, the book "Man Eating Bugs" that we mentioned earlier,
right,
which you have which you contributed a chapter to.
No, I actually was a fact checker for them.
Oh, a fact.
They're photographers, Peter Mendel and Faith Aluzio, spectacularly traveled all around the world to capture pictures of people eating bugs. So I helped with some of the identifications and some of the life histories of the. Not just insects, but scorpions, in fact, are eaten in China. Centipedes, there are all kinds of things, of arthropods that are eaten. Spiders, tarantulas are eaten.
There's tarantulas. Wait. How did tarantulas get into this?
People decided they were edible. Remember you said that Marvin Gardner said, but they're big. And there's a drumstick for eight people, right?
Okay. Well, with that, let's go to the break, and we'll be back in a few minutes with more insect lore from May Barenbaum of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. But right now, I want to say hello to Lisa Braltz and to our station manager, Bob Culkeen.
Hey, Jim, it's great to be here. Right, Lisa?
Good morning.
It is a fun drive that we're reaching out to our listeners. It's a great topic today and one that is kind of exciting, isn't it?
Well, yes, and I was just thinking to myself as I was listening to May talk about eating bugs. If your caffeine hadn't kicked in by 10 o'clock this morning, I think the topic of conversation certainly helped that along. And that's one of the things that I love most about Focus. You know, I'm sitting at my desk in the marketing department every weekday listening to Focus at 10 o'clock. It's a can't-miss program.
Absolutely. The pledge number is 217-244-9455, a local program that we bring to you 5 days a week, and it is a wonderful program. Lindsay and Jim and Scott and Jason and a whole lot of other people that are working on this program. This is the type of thing that WILL does that's different in the community than other radio stations.
And it's something that we do really well. This program has been on the air for many, many years and has undergone some changes in the last few years. But May has been a guest on the program, Lindsay said, over 50 times.
50-plus veteran.
In,
wow,
in the history
amazing.
Of the program, which is great. And we are lucky to be able to bring folks like her and other folks like her, experts in their fields, to answer your questions and to talk about what they do.
Absolutely.
That's one of the things that is so great about Focus and one of the things that is so great about WILL. We'd love to hear from you right now, 217-244-9455. You can also visit us online and pledge at willpledge.org.
We've heard from a lot of cities.
We have.
You have a list of cities
I have
we've
a list.
Heard from, and I have a list of cities we'd love to hear from by calling 217-244-9455.
I'll start.
Go
ahead.
We've
heard from Champaign. We have heard from Urbana. We've heard from Fithian. Hudsonville, Mahomet, Mattoon, Springfield. We have Urbana on here twice. We've heard from Urbana a few times. And so we're closing in on our goal for the day, but we still need to hear from...
Oh, we'd love to hear from St. Joseph, Westville, Danville, Hoopston, Allerton, and Homer. Give us a call. We have people waiting to talk with you. We know you're enjoying this program. We have a wide listening area during the day for Focus. They love to hear from Jim. He's like one of the icons in the community. When they see him out there, they say, oh, I know that guy. I know that voice.
Exactly.
And, you know, they must say that about me, too, because he's been on here 50-plus times. So only here at WILL, 217-244-9455.
Another thing that's great about this program, you know, we're talking about wanting to hear from different cities. We also, on Focus, we get to actually hear from these folks during the course of the program.
Yeah.
It's a call-in talk program where you can become a participant. It's not a common thing anymore to hear on the radio. It's something that people in this community, I know they value it a lot. Even if they don't call in or tweet now or send a message on Facebook or an email, they know that they are able to participate and they're very invested in the program. And to keep something like this on the air, I think, is really important in our community. This town likes to talk to each other. I don't know, Bob, if you've learned that in your time here. But people like to talk to each other here, and we want to keep bringing this program to
you. And the range of topics are just incredible, too.
Exactly.
I mean, you've heard chocolate-covered bugs. I mean, I never thought my day, my Monday, would have to be included with chocolate-covered bugs, and I don't know if I could eat one, to tell you the truth, but it's amazing when I think about that. The number, 217-244-9455, great topics, thought-provoking ideas, and participation from our listeners is like a winning combination
exactly.
for this program.
And we know that a lot of people come to the area every year, every fall, to become instructors at the university or students. So we know that there are potential new members out there, or maybe you've been in the community for 20 years and you've just never joined WILL, even though you enjoy the service every day. We're looking for 20 new members each day, new
That's
members,
right.
people who have never become a friend of WILL before, and we would like to get closer to that goal today. We'd love to hear from you at 217-244-9455 with your pledge of support as a new member, or you can visit willpledge.org. You can choose a sustainer option, which is giving once per month in a way that you choose. You don't have to deal with renewal notices, and you're always a friend of WILL.
And that's become more and more popular. We'd like to grow that number up because it's easier not only for our listeners, but it's also easier for us.
And you can talk about that, being the station manager and all.
Absolutely.
You know,
but you know what? Our listeners right now want to get back to this show, so we're going to bring it back to them again. Let me give you that number one more time for you to call us, 217-244-9455, or go online to willpledge.org.
We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest is University of Illinois entomologist May Barenbaum, a nationally known authority on insects. Call us with your insect questions. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Something that's been in the news recently, I guess they're coming out of the phrase, this is not their official name, but the so-called killer hornets attacking and even killing people. There have been reports, I think, in China, actually around Hong Kong. And it's apparently not a tall tale. This is a real insect, a specific insect that is suspected in this case.
Absolutely real. It's been it's not new to science, but it's pestiferousness is kind of newsworthy this year. These are the world's largest hornets, largest wasps in that group. And they're at least 3 inches long. They are in Vespa mandarinia. They are they have a very painful sting, and they are notorious for in raiding honeybee colonies. They're sort of the deadly enemies of honeybees. This season, apparently, it was a fairly dry summer. It was very conducive to building up their numbers. And in Asia, as is the case here in the U.S., people expanding development, expanding urbanization.
Building on previously untouched land?
Has put people in closer contact with giant hornets, with adverse consequences.
Now, they don't eat us.
Normally. No. They defend themselves. They defend their nests, but they are so large and can deliver so much venom that people can have adverse physiological reactions.
And so that there have been deaths from attacks by by what I guess is generally called the Asian giant hornet. There's also a subspecies, Wikipedia tells me, called the Japanese giant hornet. And I guess if they're 3 inches long, I think the wingspan's even wider. And,
right.
And I guess the venom is very toxic.
The last news story I saw indicated that over 40 people had died from lethal injection, as it were.
And so, you know, mankind has been developing in the new areas for quite a while now. Why are we just hearing about these hornets?
Well, that's always the question when an insect makes an appearance that it hasn't been around or becomes more conspicuous than it has in the past. And it's not clear. I mean, there's just sort of after-the-fact speculation. Maybe it was just a good year for them. I don't know if you've noticed this year, we have not had too many yellow jackets, at least that I've noticed. This is the time of year when yellow jackets are very conspicuous and abundant, but we're not scientifically monitoring baseline populations, so it's hard to know why there are ebbs and flows in the populations of insects until they become intrusive.
Do they come in a swarm, or would you see one individually if you were?
Well, they're social, like all hornets, They don't swarm per se, not in the same way that honeybees swarm. Honeybees have perennial colonies that live year to year. And when the colonies reach a certain size, the bees raise up a new queen and the old queen departs with about a third to half of the 30 to 40,000 members. So that's what when you see a swarm.
Mm-hmm. But if you saw, let's say you're walking in a wild area of China or the other countries, there are other Asian countries where you can find these things. Are they easily identified?
Well, they're hard to miss. Yeah.
They're pretty big. They're like we're talking 3 inches long.
Yeah.
With wings that are even wider. Do they have particular markings?
They look like hornets. They're yellow and black, you know, mm-hmm. the typical warning pattern. The stinger itself is like a quarter inch long. So,
ouch.
Yeah. And it does contain a peptide toxin, So there are two ways people die when they're stung by hymenopterans, that is bees, ants, and wasps. They can die from the effects of venom, and they can die for the effects of anaphylactic shock or allergic reaction. And most of the deaths from honeybees are generally from anaphylaxis. And it doesn't take more than a couple of stings because the body itself is overreacting to the presence of the proteins in the sting. And then you basically have an allergic reaction that kills you. But when you're attacked by hundreds of bees or hundreds of stings, you can die from the effects of the venom. In this case, you can die from the effects of just a handful of stings because it's so potent.
That's really scary. Now, yeah. Are hornets are more aggressive than, say, honeybees, I take it, anyway?
Well, hornets are honeybees are vegetarians. They don't attack animal prey. They feed only on nectar and pollen.
But hornets do attack
while they're attacking
honeybees.
Well, they love honeybees. They'll steal. They'll eat the grubs. They'll kill the workers. Other hornets, yellow jackets here, are predators. They'll eat caterpillars, other soft-bodied prey. So they are equipped to hunt, and their venom is not just purely defensive. Honeybees have no use for venom other than to teach their enemies a lesson. They're not out to kill anything. They're just out to teach you a lesson. That's why honeybee stings hurt, and that's why you remember them. There's actually a substance in bee venom called apomin that promotes long-term memory. So most people can remember the first time you were stung by a bee. The point is to teach a predator a lesson. In contrast, the venom of wasps, hornets, yellow jackets, and the like is to either immobilize prey or kill them outright. So it's a different composition, a different cocktail of biologically active materials.
Well, are there any safeguards people can take just besides keeping their wits about you and be careful where you're starting construction?
Don't go to Asia. I mean, if you don't want to get – or do you mean in hornets in general?
Well, and I guess for people in Asia, I mean, they're out – you know, millions of people are out there now in areas where these insects may be coming out. And I'm wondering if the first reaction of some people is just going to be, you know, massive insecticide, which will have its own dangerous side effects.
Well, again, I think there were 42 reported deaths thus far. But you know how many billions of people there are in Asia? I mean, it really is kind of a I don't know how many people are killed by feral dogs. But again, it's very newsworthy. It's very shocking. But it's also statistically not that likely. Here in the U.S., there are ways to avoid well, honeybees, for example, sting defensively, so avoid the honeybee nest itself. They tend to sting only in defense of the nest or if you, like, physically grab them or insult them or hurt them in some way. This time of year, yellow jackets and hornets are experienced. They're not perennial colonies. Their colonies die at the end. Only the overwintering, only the fertilized queen survives the winter. So their whole social structure is falling apart, and they do tend to get aggressive, and they're kind of at loose ends because the whole colony structure is just crumbling. So they're out and about more. They're just more easily disturbed. Yellow jackets nest in the ground. That's something to most yellow jackets nest in the ground. That's something to watch out for. Honeybees tend to, unless they're in human structures, to nest high up in trees. So they're not usually the problem when it comes to aggressive stinging.
Okay, I'm wondering also if there's a danger of these hornets being brought over accidentally, perhaps, to other parts of the world where they could cause the same sort of trouble they're causing in Asia.
Well, other wasps certainly have. We have German yellow jackets here in the eastern U.S. We have all kinds of other European hornets. We have all kinds of invasive species. It would be hard to smuggle in one of these. I mean,
well, I don't know
queen
if
one of these.
Well, I don't know if anybody would smuggle them. You know, you do need a queen, so there would have to be something that would bring a queen over, besides some supervillain intent on mayhem.
Smaller species have a higher likelihood of being accidentally imported. But I will say, not an unrealistic science fiction novel plot or movie plot would be an unscrupulous health food manufacturer bringing these guys over.
We totally forgot about that's right, because I had written it down in my notes. People actually turn, is it to these particular hornets or to other hornets?
Vespa mandarinia is the source of what's sometimes called hornet juice or VAM, V-A-A-M, which is Vespa amino acid mixture.
Google it. You'll find it on the internet.
And in fact, it was in the Australian Olympics that one of the Chinese, I think it was a cross-country team, was suspected of doping because of their extraordinary performance. And it was revealed they were just using VAM, the Vespa amino acid mixture, which has been used by Asian athletes for a long time to raise the energy level and improve performance.
Any evidence that it works on humans?
Not that I've ever seen, no.
they call it, they take it from the larva, which sounds like probably the prudent way to do it.
Yeah, and they're not milking the venom, no.
Okay. We have a caller in on line 4. Donna from Bloomington. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi there.
Hi, Donna.
I hope you haven't covered this topic already. I just started listening. Have you discussed anything at all, or is this pertinent? The cicada killer hornet that we see, mm-hmm. is that in the same category? And can you tell us the story of how those guys behave?
Oh, absolutely. It's a wonderful story. This is the largest wasp in North America. It's not technically a hornet. It's a solitary wasp, and that means it doesn't build up in big colonies like yellow jackets or paper wasps or the like. They're called cicada killers because—
That's here in North America.
Here in North America, here in the U.S., here in central Illinois, in fact. They're very large, and the females— specialize on catching not the periodical cicada, not the one that comes out in the spring every 13 or 17 years, but our annual cicada, the one that comes out every year in August, sometimes called the harvest fly or the dog day cicada. That's what she does is she captures a cicada, stings it, and then brings it back to her underground nest, The stinging paralyzes the cicada. She then lays eggs, and the hatching grubs will feed on the still-living paralyzed cicada. What they do is incredibly impressive, because if you see the relative size of these wasps, it's big for a wasp, but so are cicadas, and they're heavy. It would be like, you know, if you were to fly through the air carrying a cow. That's how difficult that is.
Wow.
Do they fly
with them? Well, they do. It's one reason they paralyze the cicada, because flying with a struggling cow would be harder than flying with a placid cow. So they sting the cicadas. They're paralyzed. And then what they do is kind of a combination. They'll have them up high on a tree, and they'll kind of fly jump to a lower level and fly jump, sort of hauling these things, and then get them to the ground and drag them into the tunnel that they've dug. Really impressive athletics for a wasp. And they will not hurt you. The male sometimes will buzz you in the face because they're territorial. They like to hang out in these sandy soils where females dig their nests before going out and hunting cicadas. And the males know that when the females are about ready to mate, when they're prospecting for nest sites. So they sort of stake out an area where females are nesting, and then whoever comes into that area they perceive as a threat. So they actually think, when they fly in your face, they think you're out after their women. But they won't sting you. Males can't sting at all. And a female cicada killer, if you grab it in your hand, yes, she has a stinger. Yes, she can puncture your skin, but she's very reluctant to do that. That's not really a defense. It's just a purely defensive move on her part. So they're not like the social wasps that are defending a colony and a nest with all kinds of offspring. Go ahead.
The tunnel that they dig is so impressive.
Yep.
I mean, we had a sidewalk, and we had 12 of these along our sidewalk because it's sandy in between.
Yep.
Now, will the next year the new baby cicadas come out of there?
I'm not sure I think they must overwinter underground. And then start the cycle. They come out late in the summer, coincident with the dog day cicadas. And they often hit the same place year after year.
Yeah.
And it might be because they're already in the neighborhood, but it also might be that there's just that unique combination of perfect habitat attributes about your yard that makes it attractive or irresistible to cicada killers.
It's just incredible to watch them dig the tunnel, and we've seen them dragging them across the sidewalk and pulling them in, and I always wonder, then what?
Yeah. Well, the paralyzed cicada, that can't be a pleasant way to go, gets hauled underground and is basically eaten alive.
Wow. Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for not asking how to kill them.
No, we won't do that.
Okay, Donna, thank you very much for calling. And this is Focus on WYLL. We still have some time for your questions about insects. For you, of entomologist Mae Barenbaum, the number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I wanted to ask you about this next subject because you said you had prepared something on it for your classes, and that is insects that come out of the category of zombie insects.
Yeah, well, first I have to say I cheated here, and the cicada killer does overwinter as a larva, not as a pupa, in an earthen cocoon underground. And we were talking about how the wasp paralyzes cicada to help. Well, there are wasps that do more than just paralyze their prey, and this has created the literature around zombie cockroaches and zombies, actually. The prey manipulation goes much beyond just paralysis. There's a little tiny wasp, Ampulex compressa, and it attacks big cockroaches, the American cockroach, which is actually African. And the cockroach is a couple inches long. The tiny, tiny wasp is maybe, I don't know, less than a quarter inch long. And what it does, first it stings the cockroach, and that immobilizes its front legs. And then while it can't defend itself, the wasp stings the brain of the cockroach, directly injects the venom into the brain of the cockroach. And this, once the front leg paralysis wears off, the cockroach is capable of moving, but it can't move on its own. If you can say cockroaches have free will, the wasp sting has destroyed its free will. And what the wasp does is nibble off the tip of the antenna, clamp onto the antenna, and then, like a dog on a leash, will walk the cockroach to its underground burrow. So the cockroach delivers itself to its doom.
So what exactly is going on here in terms of is there some sort of link then between the wasp and the cockroach's nervous system?
Well, the wasp is, as recent studies have shown, injecting a substance that interferes with the action of neurotransmitter substances. These are chemicals in the brain and elsewhere in the nervous system that make electrical connections or nerve-to-nerve connections possible. So basically, the wasp is stinging the cockroach and sort of rewiring its brain, basically to make it docile and eliminate its defensive behavior. There are some amazing examples of how parasites can manipulate their prey.
How specific can the manipulation get?
Well, that's pretty specific. Another spectacular example is another family of wasp, the Eunomans. They're also parasitoids. So there's one species that lives in a spider. It feeds on spider blood, and the spider spins its normal web, is capable of feeding itself with its prey that it catches in the web until this wasp is about to pupate. And when it pupates, it comes out of the spider's abdomen and spins a cocoon. This spider, just at that moment, by ways nobody quite understands, spins a different new kind of web, unlike any other web it's ever spun. And that web is basically a cradle for the cocoon of the emerging grub that's about to pupate. Nobody knows how this came about or how it managed, but it's amazingly sophisticated.
Okay.
It's mind control. So zombies are mindless slaves that lack free will.
Now, I think we were talking about this a little before before the program. There aren't any instances of these insects attacking, I guess, more intelligent creatures.
Well, there are other parasites that attack us and affect our behavior. And a recent series of studies have demonstrated there's a protozoan parasite called Toxoplasma, which is found in cat feces. And humans who are infected, we're kind of not an optimal host, but what happens, the way it completes its life cycle, it gets into the rats will eat it from cat feces, it gets into the rat's brain and eliminates the rat's fear of cats. So the rats basically walk up to the cats and say, go ahead, eat me, and that completes the cycle. When they get into our brains, a recent study has shown they affect behavior differently. Males become more suspicious. Women become more trusting. And both sexes, I believe, become less attentive to detail. So there are subtle behavioral changes that result from infection from parasites.
That is very interesting, especially since I don't know how you diagnose that in a human being.
Well, I get there are ways to document the presence of the parasite in the body.
Is it curable?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
But that's one reason pregnant women aren't supposed to handle cat feces because how was that for your breakfast conversation? We're talking about excrement again.
Because you could be zombified by a microbe.
You could be zombified by a microbe, yeah. Oh, and fleas, too. There are sometimes tapeworms that normally live in cats and dogs that are transmitted by fleas. They're vectors. Occasionally, humans end up as a dead-end host, and when they get into human brains, they can cause behavioral aberrations and seizures. So.
Wow, to say the least. Marcia sent along a comment. First of all, she wants to thank you, May, for the Pollinatarium.
Oh, thank you.
Which is the Pollinatarium facility on the south end of campus. You have to look for it, sort of.
Right, it's off Lincoln, off Windsor Avenue.
But a good place to find out about pollinating insects and how that whole process works.
It's open every Saturday, Sunday, 1 to 4.
And in our last couple of minutes, Marcia asks, do all insect repellents have to smell?
Well, they have to smell to the insect in order to be effective as a repellent. Well, whether they have to smell unpleasant, as it happens, there's some new research just recently announced at the American Chemical Society meeting in Indianapolis last month of a pleasant-smelling chemical that is apparently repulsive to ticks and mites, which is really good news. It's called Nutkinone, and it's from grapefruit extract, and it's being tested right now, very effective. And that's important because the standard repellents, DEET, for example, is not particularly effective against ticks And ticks are now incredibly important because they are vectors of Lyme disease and other diseases. So nutcanone should be in your nutcatone will be in your stores hopefully soon. And it smells like grapefruits.
Okay. Now, DEET, where do we get DEET from?
A laboratory. It's diethyl toluamide. It was developed in the laboratory by the military to come up with an effective repellent for troops. And it's been the staple repellent for 50 years or more.
It's not an organic chemical like
it's
this.
It's a synthetic organic chemical.
Okay.
But it's not organic in the big O sense of, plant-derived or anything.
But this new one, and is there anything particular? I mean, do insects stay away from grapefruit anyway?
Well, I don't know if ticks and mites are ever in a position to encounter grapefruits, but there are many, 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 many thousands, hundreds of thousands of plant chemicals, some of which are repellent to insects. It's up to us to figure out, and mites and ticks, it's up to us to figure out which ones are repellent to whom that we could tolerate.
That is an important factor there. There might be some things out there that we just don't want to slather on our bodies.
Right. We'd be repellent to our friends and neighbors as well.
We are out of time today on Focus. Mae Barenboim, thank you very much for being with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Been a wonderful hour, and we hope to have you back soon. Mae Barenboim is the chair of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. And today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon, and Jason Croft is our technical director. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Tomorrow on Focus, this past Friday, Governor Quinn announced he had acted on several requests for clemency, also known as request for pardons. He's been working on trying to catch up on a backlog of clemency requests. Certain amount of secrecy in the clemency process, but we hope to make it less mysterious with the help from our guest, attorney lecturer at the University of Illinois College of Law, Steve Beckett. That's on Tuesday's show. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m., and you can hear Focus over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. WYLL is listener-supported public radio. This is our fall pledge drive. To make your pledge of support, call 217-244-9455 or donate online at willpledge.org.